Tax update for Saturday, February 3rd, 2007. Welcome to Tax Update for February the 3rd, 2007. This week, the new improved health savings accounts after the Tax Relief and Health Care Act of 2006. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, this week we're going to look at some of the issues involving health savings accounts that were changed by the Tax Relief and Health Care Act of 2006 that Congress passed in December. The Congress apparently was concerned at trying to encourage people to make use of health savings accounts, because I'm not sure what everybody else's experience has been, but my experience has been that clients have not been rushing to establish such accounts. While health savings accounts have been more popular among my clients than the medical savings accounts they replaced, there's still not been an overwhelming rush. The number of clients that have HSAs, I probably can count on the fingers of one hand among our whole client base, because most of them have not been terribly happy with the concept of messing with their health insurance. So Congress is attempting to provide some incentives to get employers to adopt HSA-style plans, as well as incentives to get individuals to decide to go with the HSA concept. And some of these changes were incorporated in this recent bill. And we're going to discuss some of the ways that HSAs have been changed, some of the options that are now available for HSAs, and maybe some of the reasons why Congress has made these changes available. The first one was involved in Act Section 302A, and this Act section allows an employer to modify their flexible spending account and health reimbursement arrangement plans to allow for the funds in those plans that have not been spent, the unspent funds, to be used to fund an HSA. So an employee could take excess funds remaining in a flexible spending account, use that to fund up an HSA on a one-time basis. Now, this is a special rule that was put in just as kind of a quickie transition, and you presume, because of the way it was drafted, it was put in primarily, the thought was, to jumpstart or get people to convert the plans over. Because you're going to discover that there is a limitation on the amount that can be rolled over, and that limitation is essentially the lower of two different tests. Number one, the employee's balance in that flexible spending account or health reimbursement account on September 21st of last year, so take that number, and compare that with the balance in the account on the date of the actual distribution to the health savings account. So essentially, whatever somebody had on September 21st of last year is the most that they could transfer from a flexible spending arrangement or a health reimbursement account to a, or should I say health reimbursement account, yes, to a health savings account. That limitation then is used to carry over and be brought into the health savings account. It would appear that Congress's theory was here that people kind of didn't want to move from one to the other, and there are some complicating factors that we'll discuss later Congress is trying to clear up that made it a little more difficult to move from those plans to a health savings account and get the full deduction. So Congress is saying, look, we'll give you a one-time only option to move over. Now, employers would still have to modify their plans to allow for such rollovers, and it's probably an open question how many will do so. Congress is hopeful that a lot of employers will do this as a way to encourage employees to join basically into the HSAs on the theory that it will save the employer money in terms of the health care costs. Now, if an employee does this, they must remain an eligible individual for a full 12 months following the rollover. Or if they don't remain an eligible individual, meaning they keep the qualifying high deductible health care plan, then there's going to be a 10% penalty in the increase in tax otherwise due on that distribution. So basically, we're going to get stuck with a 10% tax plus tax on the distribution if we don't remain or keep the high deductible plans. That's to discourage employees from bailing on the plan or getting different coverages or just having the high deductible coverage long enough to fund up an HSA, after which they go back to their old traditional coverage. If an employee plans to do that, they're going to find it's an expensive way of going through this transaction. Now, to also make this work a little bit better, you may remember that Congress put some pressure on the IRS to expand the ability for flexible spending accounts so that employees did not necessarily have to worry about spending out every dollar before the end of December. So the IRS allowed employers to optionally have kind of a makeup period after the end of the year for 60 days when an employee could still incur medical expenses and use that unused reimbursement from the prior year and not face the lose it clause. Well, as we discovered, the IRS went on and said one hitch with that was that if you had that in the plan, any employee that deferred the prior year to the flexible spending account had disqualifying coverage for that carryover period in the following year, even if there was no balance left in the account at the end of December. Why? Because they could have had. They basically elected 14 months of coverage, even though they used up their entire coverage options in the 12-month period. So under that scenario, basically an employee in the year they switched from a flexible spending account arrangement to a health savings account arrangement found that they were penalized at the beginning of the year if their employer had allowed for spending after the end of the year. And they were penalized until such time as that period expired that the employer allowed them to continue to incur expenses and have them reimbursed out of the prior year deferral, even given the fact there was nothing there for the employee to have reimbursed against. There was no balance left to do the deferral with. Well, what we did, or should say, do the reimbursement with. Now, Congress has changed that, and for 2007 and later years, now this is important, this is not something your clients could take advantage of for last year, but for 2007 and later years, an individual can ignore certain FSA coverage. Now, be careful, this is not a perfect fix for the problem in determining if you have disqualifying coverage. This is basically addresses a liberalization of use it or lose it. Now, you can do this. We still have the same basic rule as that 14-month coverage is a disqualifying coverage for that 2-month period. However, you can pull that disqualifying coverage out under one of two scenarios. First, if you have a zero balance in the FSA arrangement as of the end of the prior calendar year, the previous year, then that catch-up period does not count for you. So if your balance is zero, now note, your balance must be zero. If there is anything left in the account, you have disqualifying coverage and you won't be able to get out of it under this rule. So even if you had theoretically $1 left in the account, as of January 1st, you now have disqualifying coverage for the full 2 months, even if you use up that $1 with medical expenses on January 1st. You buy the bottle of aspirin and get reimbursed for that aspirin on January 1st. That's nice, but you still have disqualifying coverage for the full 2 months. You can solve that situation if you enter the year with a balance if you make a qualifying HSA distribution under the rule we discussed previously. So if the employer's plan allows for qualifying HSA distribution, and we basically take the entire balance that existed at the end of the prior year, that $1, move that over into the HSA account under the provisions allowed for that kind of direct rollover from the health savings account or from the flexible spending arrangement, then we can disregard the balance in the flexible spending arrangement. Now, that doesn't solve all the problems. As I noted, if you entered the year with a balance and you took reimbursement, you can't just take reimbursement, then roll over the excess. That won't work. You have to roll over the entire balance at December 31st or the full disqualifying period will count. As well, you can't just spend down that balance again. You could get to zero before the end of January. That's still not going to make February a qualifying month. February would still be disqualifying under this provision. So if somebody plans to take advantage of this provision, they need to either ensure their balance got to zero by the end of the year, or they've got to freeze everything at that point and do the direct rollover to the health savings account, do the transfer over to the HSA, the distribution to the HSA from the flexible spending arrangement in order to make sure they get the qualification and they're not disqualified for those first 2 months of the year. Now, it turns out being disqualified may not be as bad as it used to be, because Act Section 303 adds a new rule that allows somebody to adopt an HSA during the year and still get the full year deduction for the HSA. I believe Congress discovered, amazingly, that individuals tend to think about tax planning and tax-related matters at the end of a year, and they think about it in terms of lessening the impact of the following April 15th. So clients tend to sit around, think about tax planning in December, and they want to see a benefit come April. Under the prior health savings account rules, if we started setting up an HSA plan and we got the insurance coverage in place for December, that was all well and good, but we could only make 1 month's worth of contributions to the HSA. That is a very minor contribution to the HSA for the year in question. Well, that didn't seem like it was worth a mother, so the client would say, well, I'll ignore it and we'll think about this next year. Next year rolls around, and of course the client puts everything back off, and again we're in November, and again the client says it's not worth the bother for this little amount for this year. I'll think about it next year. So Congress, trying to deal now with that, well, we'll think about it next year issue, has provided for a special first-year option for HSAs. In essence, Section 303 has a repeal, this is a different provision. I'm going to say the part your coverage is Section 305. 305 says we don't look at that. We get a special first-year provision. Your maximum HSA contribution beginning in 2007 is not reduced. Now, again, this is effective for 2007. For the first year you establish the HSA due to non-qualifying coverage you had earlier in the year. But you do have to remain eligible to participate in the HSA for a full 12 months after the end of the prior year. So basically, this is a requirement. So if I come into this plan, let's say I go now in December of 2007, I get my qualifying coverage, I can make a full year contribution to my HSA. However, that full year contribution to the HSA is only going to work and not be subject to a 10% additional tax plus tax on the amount of contribution I wouldn't have been allowed to make, unless I stay covered in that plan for a full 12 months following December. Other caveat that means, if I enter the plan in February, if I make the contribution that would have been disallowed except I'm going to do January, then what we're going to find is if we go through that method of calculating how much we do it, then if I don't stay covered for the full year at December of the next year, December 2008, I lose coverage, then I still have to go back and recapture that January payment. Now note, apparently once I've gone through the full year, I can do a full year 2007, I could go the full year of 2008, I've been covered for 13 months, I put in 24 months worth of contributions, I can still bail out at the beginning of 2009, having only been in for 13 months, but having 24 months or two full years of contribution. Once you get past that 1 year waiting period, we don't look back and do some fix the final year. So there is some options and some planning in that regard that may help you in terms of remaining an eligible individual. Now, I got a little ahead of myself and skipped a provision here, Section 303. Section 303 of the Act removes the cap on the HSA contribution that previously existed that limited your contribution to the HSA to the amount of your deductible or the overall cap. Now, we merely look at the overall cap to an HSA for how much we can put in. So, basically, shall we say, for the amounts that we can put in to have a high deductible health plan for a single coverage, I can have a deductible that's as low as $1,100. Even if I have $1,100 deductible, I can still put in the whole $2,850 for self-only coverage. Similarly, I can have a deductible of $2,200 for family coverage that low. I could still put back the full $5,650 for my family deductible, basically into the health savings account. So that means I can buy the lowest high deductible policy, therefore kind of insulate myself, and still kick extra into the fund. I suspect Congress sees two reasons why this might help. First, it might serve as a bribe to people that basically I'm able to put money back that I know, supposedly, or at least have pretty good feeling, isn't going to be burned up by my deductible or meeting my deductible for the health plan, that I can have a cushion in there to help cover your expenses. Secondly, that makes it even more likely that I'll have some savings in there that I will be able to use then in the future for retirement purposes, so I can basically build up this fund much faster. It's going to have more than medical in it, so I can just treat this as kind of a super IRA account for my purposes. And it gets over that little concern that many people have about the fact that they'll be underfunded. Notice a number of these provisions do deal with the underfunding feeling, and we get into some of those. We'll get into more interesting issues as to how we deal with that problem. Another one that appears to deal with concerns may be expressed by the rank and file of a small employer who is looking at establishing an HSA, where the rank and file is concerned about the fact they're going to have to pay these deductibles. We previously had an issue with comparable contributions. There was very, very little leeway in a comparable contribution. So if I make a pre-tax contribution on behalf of the participants in the health savings account in my company, I offer health savings account coverage as an optional form of insurance to my employees. The employees who take it up, I agree I'm going to put money back. I had to put either the same amount or the same percentage of the deductible in for every employee. That included the highly compensated. So I basically had to put in the same amount for everybody. Congress has made a limited change in this regard. Congress has now said, as an employer, I can basically discriminate against the highly compensated. That's the provision we find at 306. That provision, you have to kind of follow it around, and it bounces various places. But basically, a contribution to a health savings account of an employee who is not a highly compensated employee, if I have a contribution going there, the highly compensated will not be considered comparable participating employees. So the highly compensated don't have to get the same percentage. If I give $1,000 across the board to my non-highly comps, that does not mean I have to give $1,000 to the highly comp. Now, the reverse is not true. If I give $1,200 to the highly comps across the board, then I got to go back and still give $1,200 to the non-highlies. So there's a limited option here for me to discriminate against the highly compensated. I'm not sure that's really the thing keeping employers from putting this in, but the IRS seemed to be concerned that some people felt they were being forced to put money in on their own behalf as the owners of the business. They didn't want to put money into the health savings account, but they had to because they had to bribe their employees to get in. Now you can bribe your employees to make them feel good about putting the money in, but you don't have to do anything for yourself. You can ignore that. I'm not sure many of my clients are going to find that to be a really wonderful scenario for them to work with, but it is something Congress allowed. Act Section 307 is another provision that is put in the law primarily to address the concerns that there won't be enough money in my health savings account in the first year or early years to pay for my medical expenses that I'm going to be subject to now that I previously would not have had to pay had I not had the high deductible. Basically, if I had a low deductible, the insurance company would have covered it. And it allows employees or individuals to take money from their IRA accounts and basically fund their first year contribution to the health savings account from their IRA account. And in essence, or I should say, it's a once-in-a-lifetime transfer, so it doesn't have to be the first year, but obviously the idea here is we're going to allow the transfer at the first year as well as additional transfers if we go over to family coverage, that I'll be able to do a one-time transfer from my IRA to fund a year, what would have been my deductible HRA contribution, health savings account contribution for that year. The distribution will not be includable in income, and we don't get a deduction for the funding. Well, that's fine. The individual must be an eligible individual for HSA funding purposes for the 12 months beginning with the month the transfer is made. So I've got to stay eligible for 12 months. If I don't maintain that status, the entire contribution will be included in my income and subject to the 10% additional tax that early distributions from HSAs are subject to. Now note, that's involved. Now there's a question here about, what about Section 72? You may say, is that an early distribution? No, because if you take a look at the early distribution tax under Section 72, that only applies if we have a distribution from an IRA account that's includable in income. If the amount is not includable in income, then the amount is not subject to the additional tax on early distributions from an individual retirement account. So if we make this transfer, we take our transfer, we get it in there, we basically fund up our health savings account to the maximum amount. Remember, we're no longer limited to just our deductible. So we can extra fund, we can put a cushion into the health savings account. And then from that point forward, the employee can supposedly feel comfortable that as long as they keep replenishing the account and keep things up, they're not going to get nailed or won't feel as much of a chance they're going to get nailed with all these high medical expenses, that they're going to have a cushion so they're always going to see enough in the account to make them feel comfortable or make the taxpayer feel comfortable with moving forward with a health savings account. Now, obviously, the Congress is hopeful that these changes are going to make health savings accounts more attractive. So let's consider the health savings account overall. Now, probably a few things I see that go into play with health savings accounts. I happen to personally think from a financial planning perspective, they are probably a more interesting device, not so much for funding medical expenses, but for allowing you to defer funds and therefore build up this pool of money. Realize there is nothing in the law that appears to require the health savings account funds be used to pay the medical expenses in question. Therefore, it is suggested, and I think may make sense for somebody looking at this as a super IRA, to fund up such an account and then go ahead and still reach into their pocket and pay for the medical expenses incurred. But even if they use it for medical expenses, you would hope that you're not going to burn through the full deductible and the full funding amount of your health savings account every year. Therefore, it does provide a retirement building, and that's especially useful in cases where you have individuals that are deferring the maximums to their 401ks and to their various other retirement programs, are not eligible to make deductible IRA contributions, and maybe now just say, well, this is an additional place, or maybe they are making deductible IRA contributions. This is an additional place to fund some more money in and put it away from retirement. So it preserves that use, and that is something you might want to discuss with your clients as being useful. As well, theoretically, these plans are supposed to provide for a control on medical expenses. Now, that's Congress's hope by passing these. The theory is that since the employee gets to keep the money that is not given to the medical community, basically, for having performed these medical services, that the employee is going to walk in and negotiate with the provider and basically knock down the reimbursement amount for the provider, and that will serve to control medical costs. Well, practical matter is, all of these I've seen set up, the insurance company, it goes a rather traditional reimbursement route. As we all know, private pay, normally the providers demand higher pay if you go pure private pay. So almost everybody still seems to go back and get under the umbrella of the insurance company to get covered. Now, the other big problem that we've had with health savings accounts, and it continues to be a problem, is the fact that one issue that is not allowed is prescription drug coverage. Basically, what people have gotten used to, paying that fee at the pharmacy of $10 or whatever, something that does not count against their normal deductibles. Under the health savings account requirements, we are still looking at the fact that those have to count against us. So we have to pay for prescriptions. In many cases, the prescription drug benefit has been the big thing that my clients have objected to losing if they go to a health savings account. That is especially true for individuals who have chronic illnesses that have drugs that would be for them relatively expensive to make up with on a monthly basis. Those individuals have to carefully consider, if they go for a health savings account, what they get involved with the insurer and the rate the insurer has negotiated for paying those particular expenses. Otherwise, prescription drugs may basically soak up their entire deductible every year, which may mean that they never really get to use the health savings account as a savings vehicle, or it may not produce the savings for them that would be hoped for. So we do have to be careful for those coverages. Finally, remember, a health savings account, if you have any ineligible coverage, you are disallowed or kicked out of, not allowed to make an HSA contribution for that month. We have a number of provisions here now that allow us to make earlier, faster contributions, take funds from various places, but all of those require we stay eligible for a 12-month period. Now, in those cases, we have a problem if the person picks up a disqualifying coverage during that period. That's important because sometimes people pick up coverages without thinking about it or just do them with off the top of their head. Or they may talk to somebody who is selling the insurance who isn't totally up to speed on the rules in this area and basically gets them a coverage that's disqualifying. Your clients have to be aware that there are very, very strict rules about disqualifying coverage, and if they get it, there's no real fix-it or oops provision in the law that allows you to undo the problem. You just lose the ability to make the HSA contribution for that period. Or you've overfunded your HSA for that period if, in fact, we discover this fact on exam that you shouldn't have made the contribution. So we need to be aware, and clients need to be aware, of the issues and the problems that can result from HSAs and the fact they need to carefully consider their coverages. However, these new provisions do offer some options for individuals who might have had specific objections to funding the HSA. They clearly are geared primarily to those who were concerned about that initial first year or, oh no, I'm going to go for an HSA, then I'll get sick that first year, and I'm going to wipe everything out. I'm going to be in far worse shape. I have to keep the low deductible. These provisions are geared toward maybe letting those people feel comfortable, build up a cushion some way, maybe through a flexible spending account, maybe through some other means that allows them to, you know, take a good year and then go to an HSA immediately following. Things like that appear to be what Congress was kind of hoping people would be able to do under these provisions. We'll see if it really has the impact they want. Now, this has been the Tax Update for Saturday, February the 3rd, 2007. As always, the Tax Update is brought to you by Limburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limburgservices.com. Please be sure to visit them and take a look at the options and the items they have available for tax professionals who practice in these various areas. And again, on the web at www.limburgservices.com. And this has been the Tax Update for Saturday, February the 3rd, 2007.